your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Part 2, Chapter 3 of Burning Daylight by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Back at his hotel, though nearly 2 in the morning, he found the reporters waiting to interview him. Next morning there were more, and thus, with blare of paper trumpet, he was received by New York. Once more, with beating of tom-toms and wild hullabaloo, his picturesque figure strode across the printed sheet. The king of the Klondike, the hero of the Arctic, the $30 million millionaire of the North, had come to New York. What had he come for? To trim the New Yorkers, as he had trimmed the Tonopah crowd in Nevada? Wall Street had best watch out, for the wild man of the Klondike had just come to town. Or perchance, would Wall Street trim him? Wall Street had trimmed many wild men. Would this be Burning Daylight's fate? Daylight grinned to himself and gave out ambiguous interviews. It helped the game, and he grinned again as he meditated that Wall Street would sure have to go some before it trimmed him. They were prepared for him to play, and when heavy buying of Ward Valley began, it was quickly decided that he was the operator. Financial gossip buzzed and hummed. He was after the Guggenhammers once more. The story of Ophir was told over again and sensationalized until even Daylight scarcely recognized it. Still, it was grist to his mill. The stock gamblers were clearly befooled. Each day he increased his buying, and so eager were the sellers that Ward Valley rose but slowly. "It sure beats poker," Daylight whispered gleefully to himself as he noted the perturbation he was causing. The newspapers hazarded countless guesses and surmises, and Daylight was constantly dogged by a small battalion of reporters. His own interviews were gems. Discovering the delight the newspapers took in his vernacular, in his you-alls and sures and surged up, he even exaggerated these peculiarities of speech, exploiting the phrases he had heard other frontiersmen use, and inventing occasionally a new one of his own. A wildly exciting time was his during the week preceding Thursday, the 18th. Not only was he gambling as he had never gambled before, but he was gambling at the biggest table in the world, and for stakes so large that even the case-hardened habitués of that table were compelled to sit up. In spite of the unlimited selling, his persistent buying compelled Ward Valley steadily to rise, and as Thursday approached, the situation became acute. Something had to smash. How much Ward Valley was this Klondike gambler going to buy? How much could he buy? What was the Ward Valley crowd doing all this time? Daylight appreciated the interviews with them that appeared, interviews delightfully placid and non-committal. Leon Guggenhammer even hazarded the opinion that this Northland Croesus might possibly be making a mistake. But not that they cared, John Dowsett explained, nor did they object. While in the dark regarding his attentions, of one thing they were certain, namely, that he was bullying Ward Valley, and they did not mind that. No matter what happened to him and his spectacular operations, Ward Valley was all right, and would remain all right, as firm as the Rock of Gibraltar. No, they had no Ward Valley to sell. Thank you. This purely fictitious state of the market was bound shortly to pass, and Ward Valley was not to be induced to change even the tenor of its way by any insane stock exchange flurry. It is purely gambling from beginning to end, were Nathaniel Layton's words, and we refuse to have anything to do with it or to take notice of it in any way." During this time, Daylight had several secret meetings with his partners, one with Leon Guggenhammer, one with John Dowsett, and two with Mr. Howison. Beyond congratulations, they really amounted to nothing, for as he was informed, everything was going satisfactorily. But on Tuesday morning, a rumor that was disconcerting came to Daylight's ears. It was also published in the Wall Street Journal, and it was, to the effect, on apparently straight inside information, that on Thursday, when the directors of Ward Valley met, instead of the customary dividend being declared, an assessment would be levied. It was the first check Daylight had received. It came to him with a shock that if the things were so, he was a broken man. And it also came to him that all this colossal operating of his was being done on his own money. Dowsett, Guggenhammer, and Letton were risking nothing. It was a panic short-lived, it was true, but sharp enough while it lasted to make him remember Holsworthy and the brickyard, and to impel him to cancel all buying orders while he rushed to a telephone. "Nothing in it, only a rumor," came Leon Guggenhammer's throaty voice in the receiver. "As you know," said Nathaniel Letton, "I am one of the directors, and I should certainly be aware of it were such action contemplated. And John Dowsett, I warned you against just such rumors. There is not an iota of truth in it, certainly not. I tell you on my honor as a gentleman." Heartily ashamed of himself for his temporary loss of nerve, Daylight returned to his task. The cessation of buying had turned the stock exchange into a bedlam, and down all the line of stocks the bears were smashing. Ward Valley, as the ape, received the brunt of the shock and was already beginning to tumble. Daylight calmly doubled his buying orders. And all through Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday morning, he went on buying, while Ward Valley rose triumphantly higher. Still they sold, and still he bought, exceeding his power to buy many times over, when delivery was taken into account. What of that? On this day, the double dividend would be declared, he assured himself. The pinch of delivery would be on the shorts. They would be making terms with him. And then the thunderbolt struck. True to the rumor, Ward Valley levied the assessment. Daylight threw up his arms. He verified the report and quit. Not alone Ward Valley, but all securities were being hammered down by the triumphant bears. As for Ward Valley, Daylight did not even trouble to learn if it had fetched bottom or was still tumbling. Not stunned, not even bewildered, while Wall Street went mad, Daylight withdrew from the field to think it over. After a short conference with his brokers, he proceeded to his hotel. On the way, picking up the evening papers and glancing at the headlines. "Burning Daylight cleaned out," he read. "Daylight gets his. Another Westerner fails to find easy money." As he entered his hotel, a later edition announced the suicide of a young man, a lamb, who had followed Daylight's play. "What in hell do he want to kill himself for?" was Daylight's muttered comment. He passed up to his rooms, ordered a martini cocktail, took off his shoes, and sat down to think. After half an hour, he roused himself to take the drink, and as he felt the liquor pass warmingly through his body, his features relaxed into a slow, deliberate, yet genuine grin. He was laughing at himself. "Bunkled, by gosh," he muttered. Then the grin died away, and his face grew bleak and serious. Leaving out his interests in the several Western reclamation projects, which were still assessing heavily, he was a ruined man. But harder hit than this was his pride. He had been so easy. They had gold-bricked him, and he had nothing to show for it. The simplest farmer would have had documents, while he had nothing but a gentleman's agreement, and a verbal one at that. Gentleman's agreement? He snorted over it. John Dowsett's voice, just as he heard it in the telephone receiver, sounded in his ears the words, "On my honor as a gentleman." They were sneak thieves and swindlers, that's what they were, and they had given him the double cross. The newspapers were right. He had come to New York to be trimmed, and Messrs. Dowsett, Letton, and Guggenhammer had done it. He was a little fish, and they had played with him. 10 days, ample time in which to swallow him, along with his 11 millions. Of course, they had been unloading on him all the time, and now they were buying Ward Valley back for a song, ere the market righted itself. Most probably, out of his share of the swag. Nathaniel Letton would erect a couple of new buildings for that university of his. Leon Guggenhammer would buy new engines for that yacht, or a whole fleet of yachts. But what the devil Dorset would do with his whack was beyond him. Most likely start another string of banks. And Daylight sat and consumed cocktails as he saw back in his life to Alaska, and lived over the grim years in which he had battled for his 11 millions. For a while, murder ate at his heart, and wild ideas and sketchy plans of killing his betrayers flashed through his mind. That was what that young man should have done instead of killing himself. He should have gone gunning. Daylight unlocked his grip and took out his automatic pistol, a big Colt's 44. He released the safety catch with his thumb, and operating the sliding outer barrel, ran the contents of the clip through the mechanism. The 8 cartridges slid out in a stream. He refilled the clip, threw a cartridge into the chamber, and, with the trigger at full cock, thrust up the safety ratchet. He shoved the weapon into the side pocket of his coat, ordered another martini, and resumed his seat. He thought steadily for an hour, but he grinned no more. Lines formed in his face, and in those lines were the travail of the North, the bite of the frost, all that he had achieved and suffered, the long, unending weeks of trail, the bleak, tundra shore of Point Barrow, the smashing ice jam of the Yukon, the battles with animals and men, the lean, dragged days of famine, the long months of stinging hell among the mosquitoes of the Koyukuk, the toil of pick and shovel, the scars and mars of packstrap and tump line, the straight meat diet with the dogs, and all the long procession of 20 full years of toil and sweat and endeavor. At 10 o'clock he arose and pored over the city directory. Then he put on his shoes, took a cab, and departed into the night. Twice he changed cabs, and finally fetched up at the night office of a detective agency. He superintended the thing himself, laid down money in advance in profuse quantities, selected the 6 men he needed, and gave them their instructions. Never for so simple a task had they been so well paid, for to each, in addition to office charges, he gave a $500 bill with a promise of another if he succeeded. Sometime next day, he was convinced, if not sooner, his 3 silent partners would come together. To each one, 2 of his detectives were to be attached. Time and place was all he wanted to learn. "Stop at nothing, boys," were his final instructions. "I must have this information. Whatever you do, whatever happens, I'll sure see you through." Returning to his hotel, he changed cabs as before, went up to his room, and with 1 more cocktail for a nightcap, went to bed and to sleep. In the morning he dressed and shaved, ordered breakfast and the newspapers sent up, and waited. But he did not drink. By 9 o'clock his telephone began to ring, and the reports to come in. Nathaniel Letton was taking the train at Tarrytown. John Dowsett was coming down by the subway. Leon Guggenhammer had not stirred out yet, though he was assuredly within. And in this fashion, With a map of the city spread out before him, Daylight followed the movements of his three men as they drew together. Nathaniel Letton was at his offices in the Mutual Solander building. Next arrived Guggenhammer. Dowsett was still in his own offices, but at 11 came the word that he also had arrived, and several minutes later Daylight was in a hired motor car and speeding for the Mutual Solander building. End of Part 2, Chapter 3. Part 2, Chapter 4 of Burning Daylight by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Nathaniel Letton was talking when the door opened. He ceased, and with his two companions, gazed with controlled perturbation at Burning Daylight striding into the room. The free swinging movements of the trail traveler were unconsciously exaggerated in that stride of his. In truth, it seemed to him that he felt the trail beneath his feet. "Howdy, gentlemen, howdy," he remarked, ignoring the unnatural calm with which they greeted his entrance. He shook hands with them in turn, striding from one to another, and gripping their hands so heartily that Nathaniel Letton could not forbear to wince. Daylight flung himself into a massive chair and sprawled lazily with an appearance of fatigue. The leather grip he had brought into the room he dropped carelessly beside him on the floor. "God Almighty, I've sure been going some," he sighed. "We sure trimmed them beautiful. It was real slick. And the beauty of the play never dawned on me till the very end. It was pure and simple knock down and drag out. And the way they fell for it was amazing." The geniality in his lazy western drawl reassured them. He was not so formidable after all. Despite the act that he had effected an entrance into the face of Letton's instructions to the outer office, he showed no indication of making a scene or playing rough. "Well," Daylight demanded good-humoredly, "ain't you all got a good word for your partner? Or has his sure enough brilliance plumb dazzled you all?" Letton made a dry sound in his throat. Dorset sat quietly and waited, while Leon Guggenhammer struggled into articulation. "You have certainly raised Cain," he said. Daylight's black eyes flashed in a pleased way. "Didn't I, though?" he proclaimed jubilantly. "And didn't we fool 'em? I was totally surprised. I never dreamed they would be that easy." "And now," he went on, not permitting the pause to grow awkward, "we all might as well have an accounting. I'm pulling west this afternoon on that blamed 20th Century." He tugged at his grip, got it open, and dipped into it with both his hands. "But don't forget, boys, when you all want me to hornswoggle Wall Street another flutter, all you have to do is whisper the word. I'll sure be right there with the goods." His hands emerged, clutching a great mass of stubs, checkbooks, and broker's receipts. These he deposited in a heap on the big table, and dipping again, he fished out the stragglers and added them to the pile. He consulted a slip of paper drawn from his coat pocket and read aloud, $10,027,042.68 is my figuring on my expenses. Of course, that was all taken from the winnings, before we all get to figuring on the whack-up. Where's your figures? It must have been a good old mighty big clean-up." The three men looked their bepuzzlement at one another. The man was a bigger fool than they had imagined, or else he was playing a game which they could not divine. Nathaniel Letton moistened his lips and spoke up. "It will take some hours yet, Mr. Harnish, before the full accounting can be made. Mr. Howison is at work upon it now. As you say, it has been a gratifying clean-up. Suppose we have lunch together and talk it over. I'll have the clerks work through the noon hour, so that you will have ample time to catch your train." Dowsett and Guggenhammer manifested a relief that was almost obvious. The situation was clearing. It was disconcerting under the circumstances to be pent in the same room with this heavy muscled Indian-like man whom they had robbed. They remembered unpleasantly the many stories of his strength and recklessness. If Letton could only put him off long enough for the men to escape into the policed world outside the office door, all would be well. And Daylight showed all the signs of being put off. "I'm really glad to hear that," he said. "I don't want to miss that train. And y'all have done me proud, gentlemen, letting me in on this deal. I just do appreciate it without being able to express my feelings. But I am sure almighty curious, and I'd like terrible to know, Mr. Letton, what your figures of our winnings is. Can y'all give me a rough estimate?" Nathaniel Letton did not look appealingly at his two friends, but in the brief pause, they felt that appeal pass out from him. Dowsett, of sterner mold than the others, began to divine that the Klondiker was playing, but the other two were still older the blandishment of his childlike innocence. "It's extremely difficult," Leo Guggenheimer began. "You see, Ward Valley has fluctuated so, that no estimate can possibly be made in advance," Letton supplemented. Approximated, Daylight counseled cheerfully. "It don't hurt if y'all are a million or so off, one side or the other. The figures'll straighten that up. But I'm that curious, I'm just itching all over. What do you say?" "Why continue to play at cross purposes?" Dawson demanded abruptly and coldly. "Let us have the explanation here and now. Mr. Harnish is laboring under a false impression, and he should be set straight. In this deal..." But Daylight interrupted. He had played too much poker to be unaware or unappreciative of the psychological factor, and he headed Dawson off in order to play the denouncement of the present game in his own way. "Speaking of deals," he said, "reminds me of a poker game I once seen in Reno, Nevada. It wasn't what y'all would call a square game. They all was tinhorns that sat in. But there was a tenderfoot, shorthorns they are all called out there. He stands in behind the dealer and sees the same dealer give himself four aces, often the bottom of the deck. The tenderfoot is sure shocked. He slides around to the player facing the dealer across the table. 'Say,' he whispers, 'I seen that dealer deal himself four aces.' 'Well, what of it?' said the player. 'I'm trying to tell y'all because I think y'all to know,' says the tenderfoot. 'I tell y'all, I seen him deal himself four aces.' 'Say, mister,' says the player, 'y'all better get out of here. Y'all don't understand the game. It's his deal, ain't it?'" The laughter that greeted his story was hollow and perfunctory, but Daylight appeared not to notice it. "Your story has some meaning, I suppose," Dowsett said pointedly. Daylight looked at him innocently and did not reply. He turned jovially to Nathaniel Letton. "Fire away," he said. "Give us an approximation of our winnings. As I said before, a million out one way or the other won't matter. It's bound to be such an almighty big winning." By this time, Letton was stiffened by the attitude Dawson had taken, and his answer was prompt and definite. "I fear you are under a misapprehension, Mr. Harnish. There are no winnings to be divided with you. Now don't get excited, I beg of you. I have but to press this button." Far from excited, Daylight had all the seeming of being stunned. He felt absently in his vest pocket for a match, lighted it, and discovered that he had no cigarette. The three men watched him with the tense closeness of cats. Now that it had come, they knew that they had a nasty few minutes before them. "Do you all mind saying that over again?" Daylight said. "Seems to me I ain't got it just exactly right," he all said. He hung with painful expectancy on Nathaniel Letton's utterance. "I said you were under a misapprehension, Mr. Harnish, that was all. You have been stock gambling, and you have been hard hit. But neither Ward Valley nor I nor my associates feel that we owe you anything." Daylight pointed at the heap of receipts and stubs on the table. "That all represents 10 million, $27,042.68, hard cash. Ain't it good for anything here?" Letton smiled and shrugged his shoulders. Daylight looked at Dowsett and murmured, "I guess that story of mine had some meaning after all." He laughed in a sickly fashion. "It was your deal, all right. And you all dole them right, too. Well, I ain't kicking. I'm like the player in the poker game. It was your deal, and you all had a right to do your best. And you done it. Cleaned me out slicker'n a whistle." He gazed at the heap on the table with an air of stupefaction. "And that all ain't worth the paper it's written on. God dast it. You all can sure deal 'em round when you get a chance. Oh, no, I ain't a kicking. It was your deal, and you all certainly done me, and a man ain't half a man that squeals on another man's deal. And now the hand is played out, and the cards are on the table, and the deal's over, but..." His hand, dipping swiftly into his inside breast pocket, appeared with a big Colt's automatic. "As I was saying, the old deal's finished. Now it's my deal, and I'm going to see if I can hold them four aces." "Take your hand away, you white sepulchre," he cried sharply. Nathaniel Letton's hand, creeping toward the push button on the desk, was abruptly arrested. "Change chairs," Daylight commanded. "Take that chair over there, you gangrene-livered skunk. Jump, by God, or I'll make you leak till folks think your father was a water hydrant and your mother a sprinkling cart. You all move your chair alongside, Guggenhammer, and you all, Dowsett, sit right there, while I just irreverently explain the virtues of this here automatic. She's loaded for big game, and she goes off eight times. She's sure a hummer when she gets started." "Preliminary remarks being over, I now proceed to deal. Remember, I ain't making no remarks about your deal. You done your darnest, and it was all right. But this is my deal, and it's up to me to do my darndest. In the first place, y'all know me. I'm Burning Daylight, savvy. Ain't afraid of God, devil, death, nor destruction. Them's my four aces, and they sure cooper your bets. Look at that there living skeleton, Letton. You're sure afraid to die. Your bones is all rattling together, you're that scared. And look at that fat Jew there. The little weapon sure put the fear of God in his heart. He's yellow as a sick persimmon. Dowsett, you're a cool one. You ain't batted an eye nor turned a hair. That's because you're great on arithmetic, and that makes y'all dead easy in this deal of mine. You're sitting there and adding two and two together, and y'all know I sure got you skinned. You know me, and that I ain't afraid of nothing, and y'all adds up all your money, and you knows you ain't going to die if you can help it." "I'll see you hanged," was Dowsett's retort. "Not by a damn sight. When the fun starts, you're the first I plug. I'll hang all right, but y'all won't live to see it. Y'all die here now while I die subject to the law's delay. Savvy? Being dead, with grass growing out of your carcasses, you won't know when I hang, but I'll sure have the pleasure a long time of knowing y'all beat me to it." Daylight paused. "You surely wouldn't kill us?" Letton asked in a queer, thin voice. Daylight shook his head. "It's sure too expensive. Y'all ain't worth it. I'd sooner have my chips back, and I guess y'all'd sooner give my chips back than go to the dead house." A long silence followed. "Well, I've done dealt. It's up to y'all to play. But while you're deliberating, I want to give y'all a warning. If that door opens and any one of you cusses lets on there's anything unusual, right here and then, I sure start plugging. There ain't a soul that'll get out the room, except feet first." A long session of 3 hours followed. The deciding factor was not the big automatic pistol, but the certitude that Daylight would use it. Not alone were the three men convinced of this, but Daylight himself was convinced. He was firmly resolved to kill the men if his money was not forthcoming. It was not an easy matter on the spur of the moment to raise 10 millions in paper currency, and there were vexatious delays. A dozen times Mr. Howison and the head clerk were summoned into the room. On these occasions, the pistol lay on Daylight's lap, covered carelessly by a newspaper, while he was usually engaged in rolling or lighting his brown paper cigarettes. But in the end, the thing was accomplished. A suitcase was brought up by one of the clerks from the waiting motor car, and Daylight snapped it shut on the last package of bills. He paused at the door to make his final remarks. "There's three several things I sure want to tell y'all. When I get outside this door, y'all be set free to act, and I just want to warn y'all about what to do. In the first place, no warrants for my arrest, savvy? This money's mine, and I ain't robbed you of it. If it gets out how you gave me the double cross and how I done you back again, the laugh'll be on you, and it'll sure be an almighty big laugh. You can't afford that laugh. Besides, having got back my stake that you all robbed me of, if you arrest me and try to rob me a second time, I'll go gunning for you all, and I'll sure get you. No little fraid cat shrimps like you can skin Burning Daylight. If you win, you lose, and there'll sure be some several unexpected funerals around this burg. Just look me in the eye, and you all savvy I mean business. Them stubs and receipts on the table is all yourn. Good day." As the door shut behind him, Nathaniel Letton sprang for the telephone, and Dossett intercepted him. "What are you going to do?" Dossett demanded. "The police. It's downright robbery. I won't stand it. I tell you, I won't stand it." Dawson smiled grimly, but at the same time bore the slender financier back and down into his chair. "We'll talk it over," he said, and in Leon Guggenhammer he found an anxious ally. And nothing ever came of it. The thing remained a secret with the three men, nor did Daylight ever give the secret away, though that afternoon, leaning back in his stateroom at the 20th Century, his shoes off and feet on a chair, he chuckled long and heartily. New York remained forever puzzled over the affair, nor could it hit upon a rational explanation. By all rights, Burning Daylight should have gone broke, yet it was known that he immediately reappeared in San Francisco, possessing an apparently unimpaired capital. This was evidenced by the magnitude of the enterprises he engaged in, such as, for instance, Panama Mail, by sheer weight of money and fighting power, wrestling the control away from Shiftily and selling out in 2 months to the Harriman interest at a rumored enormous advance. End of Part 2, Chapter 4. Part 2, Chapter 5 of Burning Daylight by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Back in San Francisco, Daylight quickly added to his reputation. In ways it was not an enviable reputation. Men were afraid of him. He became known as a fighter, a fiend, a tiger. His play was a ripping and smashing one, and no one knew where or how his next blow would fall. The element of surprise was large. He balked on the unexpected, and fresh from the wild north, his mind not operating in stereotyped channels, he was able in unusual degree to devise new tricks and stratagems. And once he won the advantage, he pressed it remorselessly. "As relentless as a Red Indian," was said of him, and it was said truly. On the other hand, he was known as Square. His word was as good as his bond, and this despite the fact that he accepted nobody's word. He always shied at a proposition based on a gentleman's agreement, and a man who'd ventured his honor as a gentleman in dealing with Daylight inevitably was treated to an unpleasant time. Daylight never gave his own word unless he held the whip hand. It was a case with the other fellow taking it or nothing. Legitimate investment had no place in Daylight's play. It tied up his money and reduced the element of risk. It was the gambling side of business that fascinated him, and the play in his slashing manner required that his money must be ready to hand. It was never tied up save for short intervals, for he was principally engaged in turning it over and over, raiding here and there and everywhere, a veritable pirate of the financial main. A 5% safe investment had no attraction for him, but to risk millions in sharp, harsh skirmish, standing to lose everything or to win 50 or 100%, was the savor of life to him. He played according to the rules of the game, but he played mercilessly. When he got a man or a corporation down and they squealed, he gouged no less hard. Appeals for financial mercy fell on deaf ears. He was a freelance, and he had no friendly business associations. Such alliances as were formed from time to time were purely affairs of expediency, and he regarded his allies as men who would give him the double-cross or ruin him if a profitable chance presented. In spite of this point of view, he was faithful to his allies. But he was faithful just as long as they were, and no longer. The treason had to come from them, and then it was, where Daylight. The businessmen and financiers of the Pacific Coast never forgot the lesson of Charles Klinkner and the California and Altamont Trust Company. Klinkner was the president. In partnership with Daylight, the pair raided the San Jose Interurban. The powerful Lake Power and Electric Lighting Corporation came to the rescue, and Klinkner, seeing what he thought was the opportunity, went over to the enemy in the thick of the pitched battle. Daylight lost $3 million before he was done with it, and before he was done with it, he saw the California and Altamont Trust Company hopelessly wrecked, and Charles Klinkner a suicide in a felon's cell. Not only did Daylight lose his grip on San Jose Interurban, but in the crash of his battlefront, he lost heavily all along the line. It was conceded by those competent to judge that he could have compromised and saved much, but instead, he deliberately threw up the battle with San Jose Interurban and Lake Power, and apparently defeated, with Napoleonic suddenness, struck at Klinkner. It was the last unexpected thing Klinkner would have dreamed of, and Daylight knew it. He knew further that the California and Altamont Trust Company has an intrinsically sound institution, but that just then it was in a precarious condition due to Klinkner's speculations with its money. He knew also that in a few months the Trust Company would be more firmly on its feet than ever, thanks to those same speculations, and that if he were to strike, he must strike immediately. It was just that much money in pocket and a whole lot more, he was reported to have said, in connection with his heavy losses. It was just so much insurance against the future. Henceforth, men who go in with me on deals will think twice before they try to double-cross me, and then some. The reason for his savageness was that he despised the men with whom he played. He had a conviction that not one in 100 of them was intrinsically square, and as for the square ones, he prophesied that, playing in a crooked game, they were sure to lose and in the long run go broke. His New York experience had opened his eyes. He tore the veils of illusion from the business game and saw its nakedness. He generalized upon industry and society somewhat as follows. Society as organized was a vast bunco game. There were many hereditary inefficients, men and women, who were not weak enough to be confined in feeble-minded homes, but who were not strong enough to be aught else than hewers of wood and drawers of water. Then there were the fools who took the organized bunco game seriously, honoring and respecting it. They were easy game for the others, who saw clearly and knew the bunco game for what it was. Work, legitimate work, was the source of all wealth. That was to say, whether it was a sack of potatoes, a grand piano, or a seven-passenger touring car, it came into being only by the performance of work. Where the bunco came in was in the distribution of these things after labor had created them. He failed to see the horny-handed sons of toil enjoying grand pianos or riding in automobiles. How this came about was explained by the bunco. By tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands, men sat up nights and schemed how they could get between the workers and the things the workers produced. These schemers were the businessmen. When they got between the worker and his product, they took a whack out of it for themselves. The size of the whack was determined by no rule of equity, but by their own strength and swinishness. It was always a case of all the traffic can bear. He saw all men in the business game doing this. One day, in a mellow mood, induced by a string of cocktails and a hearty lunch, he started a conversation with Jones, the elevator boy. Jones was a slender, mop-headed, man-grown, truculent flame of an individual who seemed to go out of his way to insult his passengers. It was this that attracted Daylight's interest, and he was not long in finding out what was the matter with Jones. He was a proletarian, according to his own aggressive classification, and he had wanted to write for a living. Failing to win with the magazines, and compelled to find himself in food and shelter, he had gone to the little valley of Pacheca, not 100 miles from Los Angeles. Here, toiling in the daytime, he planned to write and study at night. But the railroad charged all the traffic would bear. Pacheca was a desert valley and produced only 3 things, cattle, firewood, and charcoal. For freight to Los Angeles, on a carload of cattle, the railroad charged $8. This, Jones explained, was due to the fact that the cattle had legs and could be driven to Los Angeles at a cost equivalent to the charge per carload. But firewood had no legs, and the railroad charged just precisely $24 a carload. This was a fine adjustment, for by working hammer and tongs through a 12-hour day, after freight had been deducted from the selling price of the wood in Los Angeles, the woodchopper received $1.60. Jones had thought to get ahead of the game by turning his wood into charcoal. His estimates were satisfactory, but the railroad also made estimates. It issued a rate of $42 a car on charcoal. At the end of 3 months, Jones went over his figures and found that he was still making $1.60 a day. "So I quit," Jones concluded. "I went hobbling for a year, and I got back at the railroads. Leaving out the little things, I came across the Sierras in the summer and touched a match to the snow sheds. They only had a little $30,000 fire. I guess that squared up all balances due on Pacheca." "Son, ain't you afraid to be turning loose such information?" Daylight gravely demanded. "Not on your life," quoth Jones. "They can't prove it. You could say I said so, and I could say I didn't say so, and a hell of a lot that evidence would amount to with a jury." Daylight went into his office and meditated a while. That was it. All the traffic would bear. From top to bottom, that was the rule of the game. And what kept the game going was the fact that a sucker was born every minute. If a Jones were born every minute, the game wouldn't last very long. Lucky for the players that the workers weren't Joneses. But there were other and larger phases of the game. Little businessmen, shopkeepers, and such ilk, took what whack they could out of the product of the worker. But after all, it was the large businessmen who formed the workers through the little businessmen. When all was said and done, the latter, like Jones in Pacheca Valley, had no more than wages out of their whack. In truth, they were hired men for the large businessmen. Still again, higher up, were the big fellows. They used vast and complicated paraphernalia for the purpose on a large scale of getting between hundreds of thousands of workers and their products. These men were not so much mere robbers as gamblers, and not content with their direct winnings, being essentially gamblers, they raided one another. They called this feature of the game high finance. They were all engaged primarily in robbing the worker, but every little while they formed combinations and robbed one another of the accumulated loot. This explained the $50,000 raid on him by Holdsworthy and the $10 million raid on him by Dowsett, Letton, and Guggenhammer. And when he raided Panama Mail, he had done exactly the same thing. Well, he concluded, it was finer sport robbing the robbers than robbing the poor, stupid workers. Thus, all unread in philosophy, Daylight preempted for himself the position and vocation of a 20th-century Superman. He found, with rare and mythical exceptions, that there was no noblesse oblige among the business and financial supermen. As a clever traveler had announced in an after-dinner speech at the Alta Pacific, there was honor among thieves, and this was what distinguished thieves from honest men. That was it. It hit the nail on the head. These modern supermen were a lot of sordid banditti who had the successful effrontery to preach a code of right and wrong to their victims which they themselves did not practice. With them, a man's word was good just as long as he was compelled to keep it. Thou shalt not steal was only applicable to the honest worker. They, the supermen, were above such commandments. They certainly stole and were honored by their fellows according to the magnitude of their stealings. The more Daylight played the game, the clearer the situation grew. Despite the fact that every robber was keen to rob every other robber, the band was well organized. It practically controlled the political machinery of society, from the ward politician up to the Senate of the United States. It passed laws that gave it privilege to rob. It enforced these laws by means of the police, the marshals, the militia, and the regular army, and the courts. And it was a snap. A superman's chiefest danger was his fellow superman. The great stupid mass of the people did not count. They were constituted of such inferior clay that the veriest chicanery fooled them. The superman manipulated the strings, and when robbery of the workers became too slow or monotonous, they turned loose and robbed one another. Daylight was philosophical, but not a philosopher. He had never read the books. He was a hard-headed, practical man, and farthest from him was any intention of ever reading the books. He had lived life in the simple, where books were not necessary for an understanding of life, and now life in the complex appeared just as simple. He saw through its frauds and fictions, and found it as elemental as on the Yukon. Men were made of the same stuff. They had the same passions and desires. Finance was poker on a larger scale. The men who played were the men who had stakes. The workers were the fellows toiling for grubstakes. He saw the game played out accordingly to the everlasting rules, and he played a hand himself. The gigantic futility of humanity organized and befuddled by the bandits did not shock him. It was a natural order. Practically all human endeavors were futile. He had seen so much of it. His partners had starved and died on the Stewart. Hundreds of old-timers had failed to locate on Bonanza and El Dorado, while Swedes and Chechakos had come in on the Moose Pasture and blindly staked millions. It was life, and life was a savage proposition at best. Men in civilization robbed because they were so made. They robbed just as cats scratched, famine pinched, and frost bit. So it was that Daylight became a successful financier. He did not go in for swindling the workers. Not only did he not have the heart for it, but it did not strike him as a sporting proposition. The workers were so easy, so stupid. It was almost like slaughtering fat, hand-reared pheasants on the English preserves he had heard about. The sport to him was in waylaying the successful robbers and taking their spoils from them. There was fun and excitement in that, and sometimes they put up the very devil of a fight. Like Robin Hood of old, Daylight proceeded to rob the rich and in small way to distribute to the needy. But he was charitable after his own fashion. The great mass of human misery meant nothing to him. That was part of the everlasting order. He had no patience with the organized charities and the professional charity mongers. Nor, on the other hand, was what he gave a conscious dole. He owed no man, and restitution was unthinkable. What he gave was a largesse, a free, spontaneous gift, and it was for those about him. He never contributed to an earthquake fund in Japan, nor to an open-air fund in New York City. Instead, he financed Jones, the elevator boy, for a year that he might write a book. When he learned that the wife of his waiter at the St. Francis was suffering from tuberculosis, he sent her to Arizona, and later, when her case was declared hopeless, he sent the husband, too, to be with her to the end. Likewise, he bought a string of horsehair bridles from a convict in a western penitentiary, who spread the good news, until it seemed to Daylight, that half the convicts in that institution were making bridles for him. He bought them all, paying from $20 to $50 each for them. They were beautiful and honest things, and he decorated all the available wall space of his bedroom with them. The grim Yukon life had failed to make Daylight hard. It required civilization to produce this result. In the fierce, savage game he now played, his habitual geniality imperceptibly slipped away from him, as did his lazy western drawl. His speech became sharp and nervous, so did his mental processes. In the swift rush of the game, he found less and less time to spend on being merely good-natured. The change marked his face itself. The lines grew sterner. Less often appeared the playful curl of his lips, the smile in the wrinkling corners of his eyes. The eyes themselves, black and flashing like an Indian's, betrayed glints of cruelty and brutal consciousness of power. His tremendous vitality remained and radiated from all his being. But it was vitality under the new aspect of the man-trampling, man-conqueror. His battles with elemental nature had been, in a way, impersonal. His present battles were wholly with the male of his species, and the hardships of the trail, the river, and the frost marred him far less than the bitter keenness of the struggle with his fellows. He still had recrudescence of geniality, but they were largely periodical and forced, and they were usually due to cocktails he took prior to mealtime. In the north he had drunk deeply and at irregular intervals, but now his drinking became systematic and disciplined. It was an unconscious development, but it was based upon physical and mental condition. The cocktail served as an inhibition. Without reasoning or thinking about it, the strain of the office, which was essentially due to the daring and audacity of his ventures, required check or cessation, and he found, through the weeks and months, that the cocktail supplied this very thing. They constituted a stone wall. He never drank during the morning, nor in office hours, but the instant he left the office, he proceeded to rear this wall of alcohol inhibition athwart his consciousness. The office became immediately a closed affair. It ceased to exist. In the afternoon, after lunch, it lived again for 1 or 2 hours, when, leaving it, he rebuilt the wall of inhibition. Of course there were exceptions to this, and such was the rigor of his discipline that if he had a dinner or a conference before him in which, in a business way, he encountered enemies or allies and planned to prosecute campaigns, he abstained from drinking. But the instant the business was settled, his everlasting call went out for a martini, and for a double martini at that, served in a long glass, so as not to excite comment. End of Part 2, Chapter 5. Part 2, Chapter 6 of Burning Daylight by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Into Daylight's life came Dede Mason. She came rather imperceptibly. He had accepted her impersonally, along with the office furnishings, the office boy, Morrison, the chief, confidential and only clerk, and all the rest of the accessories of a superman's gambling place of business. Had he been asked any time during the first months she was in his employ, he would have been unable to tell the color of her eyes. From the fact that she was a demi-blonde, there resided dimly in his subconsciousness a conception that she was a brunette. Likewise, he had an idea that she was not thin, while there was an absence in his mind of any idea that she was fat. As to how she dressed, he had no ideas at all. He had no trained eye in such matters, nor was he interested. He took it for granted, in the lack of any impression to the contrary, that she was dressed somehow. He knew her as Miss Mason, and that was all, though he was aware that as a stenographer she seemed quick and accurate. This impression, however, was quite vague, for he had no experience with other stenographers, and naturally believed that they were all quick and accurate. One morning, signing up letters, he came upon an "I shall." Glancing quickly over the page for similar constructions, he found a number of "I wills." The "I shall" was alone. It stood out conspicuously. He pressed the call bell twice, and a moment later, Dede Mason entered. "Did I say that, Miss Mason?" he asked, extending the letter to her and pointing out the criminal phrase. A shade of annoyance crossed her face. She stood convicted. "My mistake," she said. "I'm sorry, but it's not a mistake, you know," she added quickly. "How do you make that out?" challenged Daylight. "It sure don't sound right, in my way of thinking." She had reached the door by this time, and now turned the offending letter in her hand. "It's right just the same." "But that would make all those I wills wrong, then," he argued. "It does," was her audacious answer. "Shall I change them?" "I shall be over to look up that affair on Monday," Daylight repeated the sentence from the letter aloud. He did it with a grave, serious air, listening intently to the sound of his own voice. He shook his head. "It don't sound right, Miss Mason. It just don't sound right. Why, nobody writes to me that way. They all say I will. Educated men, too, some of them. Ain't that so?" "Yes," she acknowledged, and passed out to her machine to make the correction. It chanced that day that among several men with whom he sat at luncheon was a young Englishman, a mining engineer. Had it happened at any other time, it would have passed unnoticed. But, fresh from the tilt with his stenographer, Daylight was struck immediately by the Englishman's "I shall." Several times in the course of the meal, the phrase was repeated, and Daylight was certain there was no mistake about it. After luncheon, he cornered McIntosh, one of the members whom he knew to have been a college man because of his football reputation. "Look here, Bunny," Daylight demanded, "which is right? I shall be over to look that affair up on Monday, or I will be over to look that affair up on Monday?" The ex-football captain debated painfully for a minute. "Blessed if I know," he confessed. "Which way do I say it?" "Oh, I will, of course." "Then the other is right, depend upon it. I was always rotten on grammar." On the way back to the office, Daylight dropped into a bookstore and bought a grammar, and for a solid hour, his feet up on the desk, he toiled through its pages. "Knock off my head with little apples, if the girl ain't right," he communed aloud at the end of the session. For the first time it struck him that there was something about his stenographer. He had accepted her up to then as a female creature and a bit of office furnishing, but now, having demonstrated that she knew more grammar than did businessmen and college graduates, she became an individual. She seemed to stand out in his consciousness as conspicuously as the eye shell had stood out on the typed page, and he began to take notice. He managed to watch her leaving that afternoon, and he was aware for the first time that she was well-formed and that her manner of dress was satisfying. He knew none of the details of women's dress, and he saw none of the details of her neat shirt-waist and well-cut tailor suit. He saw only the effect in a general, sketchy way. She looked right. This was in the absence of anything wrong or out of the way. "She's a trim little good-looker," was his verdict, when the outer office door closed on her. The next morning, dictating, he concluded that he liked the way she did her hair, though for the life of him he could have given no description of it. The impression was pleasing, that was all. She sat between him and the window, and he noted that her hair was light brown, with hints of golden bronze. A pale sun shining in touched the golden bronze into smoldering fires that were very pleasing to behold. Funny, he thought, that he had never observed this phenomenon before. In the midst of the letter he came to the construction, which had caused the trouble the day before. He remembered to wrestle with the grammar, and dictated, "I shall meet you halfway this proposition." Miss Mason gave a quick look up at him. The action was purely involuntary, and in fact had been half a startle of surprise. The next instant her eyes dropped again, and she sat waiting to go on with the dictation. But in that moment of her glance, Daylight had noted that her eyes were gray. He was later to learn that at times there were golden lights in those same gray eyes. But he had seen enough, as it was, to surprise him, for he became suddenly aware that he had always taken her for a brunette with brown eyes, as a matter of course. "You were right after all," he confessed with a sheepish grin that sat incongruously on his stern, Indian-like features. Again he was rewarded by an upward glance and an acknowledging smile, and this time he verified the fact that her eyes were gray. "But it don't sound right just the same," he complained. At this, she laughed outright. "I beg your pardon," she hastened to make amends, and then spoiled it by adding, "but you are so funny." Daylight began to feel a slight awkwardness, and the sun would persist in setting her hair a-smoldering. "I didn't mean to be funny," he said. "That was why I laughed, but it's right and perfectly good grammar." "All right," he sighed. "I shall meet you halfway in this proposition. Got that?" And the dictation went on. He discovered that in the intervals, when she had nothing to do, she read books and magazines, or worked on some sort of feminine fancy work. Passing her desk once, he picked up a volume of Kipling's poems and glanced bepuzzled through the pages. "You like reading, Miss Mason?" he said, laying down the book. "Oh, yes," was her answer, "very much." Another time it was a book of Wells, The Wheels of Change. "What's it all about?" Daylight asked. "Oh, it's just a novel, a love story," she stopped, but he still stood waiting, and she felt it incumbent to go on. "It's about a little Cockney's draper's assistant who takes a vacation on his bicycle and falls in love with a young girl very much above him. Her mother is a popular writer and all that, and the situation is very curious and sad, too, and tragic. Would you care to read it?" "Does he get her?" Daylight demanded. "No, that's the point of it. He wasn't." "And he doesn't get her, and you've read all them pages, hundreds of them, to find that out?" Daylight muttered in amazement. Miss Mason was nettled as well as amused. "But you read the mining and financial news by the hour," she retorted. "But I sure get something out of that. It's business, and it's different. I get money out of it. What do you get out of books?" "Points of view, new ideas, life." Not worth a cent cash. But life's worth more than cash, she argued. Oh, well, he said, with easy masculine tolerance. So long as you enjoy it, that's what counts, I suppose. And there's no accounting for taste. Despite his own superior point of view, he had an idea that she knew a lot, and he experienced a fleeting feeling like that of a barbarian face to face with the evidence of some tremendous culture. To Daylight, culture was a worthless thing, and yet somehow he was vaguely troubled by a sense that there was more in culture than he imagined. Again on her desk in passing, he noticed a book with which he was familiar. This time he did not stop, for he had recognized the cover. It was a magazine correspondence book on the Klondike, and he knew that he and his photograph figured in it, and he knew also of a certain sensational chapter concerned with a woman's suicide, and one with too much daylight. After that, he did not talk with her again about books. He imagined what erroneous conclusions she had drawn from that particular chapter, and it stung him the more in that they were undeserved. Of all the unlikely things, to have the reputation of being a lady killer, he, Burning Daylight, and to have a woman kill herself out of love for him. He felt that he was a most unfortunate man, and wondered by what luck that one book of all the thousands of books should have fallen into a stenographer's hands. For some days afterwards he had an uncomfortable sensation of guiltiness whenever he was in Miss Mason's presence. And once he was positive that he caught her looking at him with a curious, intent gaze, as if studying what manner of man he was. He pumped Morrison, the clerk, who had first to vent his personal grievance against Miss Mason, before he could tell what little he knew of her. She comes from Siskiyou County. She's very nice to work with in the office, of course, but she's rather stuck on herself, exclusive, you know. How do you make that out? Daylight queried. Well, she thinks too much of herself to associate with those she works with, in the office here, for instance. She won't have anything to do with a fellow, you see. I've asked her out repeatedly, to the theater and the shoots and such things, but nothing doing. She says she likes plenty of sleep and can't stay up late, and has to go all the way to Berkeley. That's where she lives. This phase of the report gave Daylight a distinct satisfaction. She was a bit above the ordinary, and no doubt about it. But Morrison's next words carried a hurt. But that's all hot air. She's running with the university boys, that's what she's doing. She needs lots of sleep and can't go to the theater with me, but she can dance all hours with them. I've heard it pretty straight that she goes to all their hops and such things. Rather stylish and high toned for a stenographer, I'd say. And she keeps a horse, too. She rides astride all over those hills out there. I saw her one Sunday myself. Oh, she's a high flyer, and I wonder how she does it. 65 a month doesn't go far. Then she has a sick brother, too. Live with her people? Daylight asked. No, hasn't got any. They were well-to-do, I've heard. They must have been, or that brother of hers couldn't have gone to the University of California. Her father had a big cattle ranch, but he got the fooling with mines or something, and went broke before he died. Her mother died long before that. Her brother must cost a lot of money. He was a husky once, played football, was great on hunting and being out in the mountains and such things. He got his accident breaking horses, and then rheumatism or something got into him. One leg is shorter than the other and withered up some. He has to walk on crutches. I saw her out with him once, crossing the ferry. The doctors have been experimenting on him for years, and he's in the French hospital now, I think. All of which sidelights on Miss Mason went to increase Daylight's interest in her. Yet, much as he desired, he failed to get acquainted with her. He had thoughts of asking her to luncheon, but his was the innate chivalry of the frontiersman, and the thoughts never came to anything. He knew a self-respecting, square-dealing man was not supposed to take his stenographer to luncheon. Such things did happen, he knew, for he heard the chafing gossip of the club. But he did not think much of such men and felt sorry for the girls. He had a strange notion that a man had less rights over those he employed than over mere acquaintances or strangers. Thus, had Miss Mason not been his employee, he was confident that he would have had her to luncheon or to the theater in no time. But he felt that it was an imposition for an employer, because he bought the time of an employee in working hours, to presume in any way upon any of the rest of that employee's time. To do so was to act like a bully. The situation was unfair. It was taking advantage of the fact that the employee was dependent on one for a livelihood. The employee might permit the imposition through fear of angering the employer, and not through any personal inclination at all. In his own case, he felt that such an imposition would be peculiarly obnoxious, for had she not read that cursed Klondike correspondence book? A pretty idea she must have him, a girl that was too high-toned to have anything to do with a good-looking, gentlemanly fellow like Morrison. Also, and down under all his other reasons, Daylight was timid. The only thing he had ever been afraid of in his life was women, and he had been afraid all his life. Nor was that timidity to be put easily to flight, now that he felt the first glimmering need and desire for a woman. The specter of the apron string still haunted him, and helped him to find excuses for getting on no forwarder with Dede Mason. End of Part 2, Chapter 6. Part 2, Chapter 7 of Burning Daylight by Jack London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Not being favored by chance in getting acquainted with Dede Mason, Daylight's interest in her slowly waned. This was but natural, for he was plunged deep in hazardous operations, and the fascination of the game and the magnitude of it accounted for all the energy that even his magnificent organism could generate. Such was his absorption that the pretty stenographer slowly and imperceptibly faded from the forefront of his consciousness. Thus the first faint spur, in the best sense, of his need for woman ceased to prod. So far as Dede Mason was concerned, he possessed no more than a complacent feeling of satisfaction in that he had a very nice stenographer, and, completely to put the quietus on any last lingering hopes he might have had of her, he was in the thick of a spectacular and intensely bitter fight with the Coastwise Steam Navigation Company and the Hawaiian, Nicaraguan, and Pacific Mexican Steamship Company. He stirred up a bigger muss than he had anticipated, and even he was astounded at the wide ramifications of the struggle, and at the unexpected and incongruous interests that were drawn into it. Every newspaper in San Francisco turned upon him. It was true, one or two of them had first intimated that they were open to subsidization, but Daylight's judgment was that the situation did not warrant such expenditure. Up to this time, the press had been amusingly tolerant and good-naturedly sensational about him, but now he was to learn what virulent scrupulousness an antagonized press was capable of. Every episode of his life was resurrected to serve as foundations for malicious fabrications. Daylight was frankly amazed at the new interpretation put upon all he had accomplished and the deeds he had done. From an Alaskan hero, he was metamorphed into an Alaskan bully, liar, desperado, and all-around bad man. Not content with this, lies upon lies, out of whole cloth, were manufactured about him. He never replied, though once he went to the extent of disburdening his mind to half a dozen reporters. "Do your damnedest," he told them. "Burning Daylight's bucked bigger things than your dirty, lying sheets." And I don't blame you, boys. That is, not much. You can't help it. You've got to live. There's a mighty lot of women in this world that make their living in a similar fashion to yours, because they're not able to do anything better. Somebody's got to do the dirty work, and it might as well be you. You're paid for it, and you ain't got the backbone to rustle cleaner jobs. The socialist press of the city jubilantly exploited this utterance, scattering it broadcast over San Francisco in tens of thousands of paper dodgers. And the journalists, stung to the quick, retaliated with the only means in their power, printer's ink abuse. The attack became bitterer than ever. The whole affair sank to deeper depths of rancor and savageness. The poor woman who had killed herself was dragged out of her grave and paraded on thousands of reams of paper as a martyr and a victim of Daylight's ferocious brutality. Staid statistical articles were published, proving that he had made his start by robbing poor miners of their claims, and that the capstone to his fortune had been put in place by his treacherous violation of faith with the Guggenhammers in the deal on Ophir. And there were editorials written in which he was called an enemy of society, possessed of the manners and culture of a caveman, a fermenter of wasteful business troubles, the destroyer of the city's prosperity in commerce and trade, an anarchist of dire menace. And one editorial gravely recommended that hanging would be a lesson to him and his ilk, and concluded with a fervent hope that some day his big motor car would smash up and smash him with it. He was like a big bear raiding a beehive, and regardless of the stings, he obstinately persisted in pawing for the honey. He gritted his teeth and struck back. Beginning with a raid on two steamship companies, it developed into a pitched battle with a city, a state, and a continental coastline. Very well, they wanted fight, and they would get it. It was what he wanted, and he felt justified in having come down from the Klondike, for here he was gambling at a bigger table than ever the Yukon had supplied. Allied with him, on a splendid salary, with princely pickings thrown in, was a lawyer, Larry Hagan, a young Irishman with a reputation to make, and whose peculiar genius had been unrecognized until Daylight picked up with him. Hagan had Celtic imagination and daring, and to such a degree that Daylight's cooler head was necessary as a check on his wilder visions. Hagan's was a Napoleonic legal mind without balance, and it was just this balance that Daylight supplied. Alone, the Irishman was doomed to failure, but directed by Daylight, he was on the high road to fortune and recognition. Also, he was possessed of no more personal or civic conscience than Napoleon. It was Hagan who guided Daylight through the intricacies of modern politics, labor organization, and commercial and corporation law. It was Hagan, prolific of resource and suggestion, who opened Daylight's eyes to undreamed possibility in 20th-century warfare. And it was Daylight, rejecting, accepting, and elaborating, who planned the campaigns and prosecuted them. With the Pacific coast from Puget Sound to Panama buzzing and humming, and with San Francisco furiously about his ears, the two big steamship companies had all the appearance of winning. It looked as if Burning Daylight was being beaten slowly to his knees. And then he struck at the steamship companies, at San Francisco, at the whole Pacific coast. It was not much of a blow at first, a Christian Endeavor convention being held in San Francisco. A row was started by Express Drivers Union, number 927, over the handling of a small heap of baggage at the ferry building. A few heads were broken, a score of arrests made, and the baggage was delivered. No one would have guessed that behind this petty wrangle was the fine Irish hand of Hagan, made potent by the Klondike gold of Burning Daylight. It was an insignificant affair at best, or so it seemed. But the Teamsters Union took up the quarrel, backed by the whole Waterfront Federation. Step by step, the strike became involved. A refusal of cooks and waiters to serve scab teamsters or teamsters' employers brought out the cooks and waiters. The butchers and meat cutters refused to handle meat destined for unfair restaurants. The Combined Employers Association put up a solid front and found facing them the 40,000 organized laborers of San Francisco. The restaurant bakers and the bakery wagon drivers struck, followed by the milkers, milk drivers, and chicken pickers. The building trades asserted its position in unambiguous terms, and all San Francisco was in turmoil. But still, it was only San Francisco. Hagen's intrigues were masterly, and Daylight's campaign steadily developed. The powerful fighting organization, known as the Pacific Slope Seamen's Union, refused to work vessels, the cargoes of which were to be handled by scab longshoremen and freight handlers. The union presented its ultimatum and then called a strike. This had been Daylight's objective all the time. Every incoming coastwise vessel was boarded by union officials and its crew sent ashore. And with the seamen went the firemen, the engineers, and the sea cooks and waiters. Daily the number of idle steamers increased. It was impossible to get scab crews, for the men of the Seamen's Union were fighters trained in the hard school of the sea, and when they went out, it meant blood and death to scabs. This phase of the strike spread up and down the entire Pacific coast, until all ports were filled with idle ships and sea transportation was at a standstill. The days and weeks dragged out, and the strike held. The Coastwise Steam Navigation Company and the Hawaiian, Nicaraguan, and Pacific Mexican Steamship Company were tied up completely. The expenses of combating the strike were tremendous, and they were earning nothing, while daily the situation went from bad to worse, until peace at any price became the cry. And still there was no peace until Daylight and his allies played out their hand, raked in the winnings, and allowed a goodly portion of a continent to resume business. It was noted in following years that several leaders of workmen built themselves houses and blocks of renting flats and took trips to the old countries, while more immediately other leaders and dark horses came to political preferment and the control of the municipal government and the municipal monies. In fact, San Francisco's boss-ridden condition was due in greater degree to Daylight's wide-spreading battle than even San Francisco ever dreamed. For the part he had played, the details of which were practically all rumor and guesswork, quickly leaked out, and in consequence he became a much execrated and well-hated man. Nor had Daylight himself dreamed that his raid on the steamship companies would have grown to such colossal proportions. But he had got what he was after. He had played an exciting hand and won, beating the steamship companies down into the dust and mercilessly robbing the stockholders by perfectly legal methods before he let go. Of course, in addition to the large sums of money he had paid over, his allies had rewarded themselves by gobbling the advantages which later enabled them to loot the city. His alliance with a gang of cutthroats had brought about a lot of cutthroating, but his conscience suffered no twinges. He remembered what he had once heard an old preacher utter, namely, that they who rose by the sword perished by the sword. One took his chances when he played with cutting throats, and his, Daylight's throat, was still intact. That was it, and he had won. It was all gamble and war between the strong men. The fools did not count. They were always getting hurt, and that they always had been getting hurt was the conclusion he drew from what little he knew of history. San Francisco had wanted war, and he had given it war. It was the game. All the big fellows did the same, and they did much worse, too. "Don't talk to me about morality and civic duty," he replied to a persistent interviewer. "If you quit your job tomorrow and went to work on another paper, You would write just what you were told to write. It's morality and civic duty now with you. On the new job, it would be backing up a thieving railroad with morality and civic duty, I suppose. Your price, my son, is just about 30 per week. That's what you sell for. But your paper would sell for a bit more. Pay its price today, and it would shift its present rotten policy to some other rotten policy. But it would never let up on morality and civic duty. And all because a sucker is born every minute. So long as the people stand for it, they'll get it good and plenty, my son. And the shareholders and business interests might as well shut up squawking about how much they've been hurt. You never hear ary a squeal out of them when they've got that other fellow down and are gouging him. This is the time. They got gouged, and that's all there is to it. Talk about mollycoddles. Son, those same fellows would steal crusts from starving men and pull gold fillings from the mouths of corpses. Yep. And squawk like Sam Scratch if some blamed corpse hit back. They're all tarred with the same brush, little and big. Look at your sugar trust, with all its millions stealing water like a common thief from New York City, and short weighing the government on its phony scales. Morality and civic duty? Son, forget it. End of Part 2, Chapter 7.
Rose is your name, but when you poop, it sure don't smell like roses. You're number two, burns the hair in my nose. But we fought hand in paw, now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear, my sweet rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.